Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the January 27th Thursday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Supreme Court, Justice Breyer to retire. Biden has promised to pick a black woman. By Mark Sherman and Michael Balsamo. Dems seek swift confirmation to fill Supreme Court opening by Mary Claire Jelinek and Lisa Mascaro. Supreme Court, three considered frontrunners as Biden mulls pick by Colleen Long, Zeke Miller, Michael Balsamo, and Jessica Gresko. Arson killed five. Judge, two teens to be tried as adults by Elise Schmelzer. Supreme Court, Justice Breyer to retire, Biden has promised to pick a black woman, by Mark Sherman and Michael Balsamo, The Associated Press, byline, Washington. Longtime liberal Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer is retiring, numerous sources said Wednesday, giving President Joe Biden his first high court opening, which he has pledged to fill with the historic naming of the court's first black woman. Breyer, 83, has been a pragmatic force on a court that has grown increasingly conservative, trying to forge majorities with more moderate justices right and left of center. His retirement will give Biden the chance to name and win confirmation of a replacement before next fall's election, when Republicans could retake the Senate and block further nominees. Democrats are planning a swift confirmation, perhaps even before Breyer officially steps down, which is not expected before summer. He has been a justice since 1994, appointed by President Bill Clinton. Along with the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, he opted not to step down the last time the Democrats controlled the White House and the Senate during Barack Obama's presidency. Ginsburg died in September 2020, and then-President Donald Trump filled the vacancy with a conservative justice, Amy Coney Barrett. Breyer's departure won't change the 6-3 conservative advantage on the court. It will make conservative Justice Clarence Thomas the oldest member of the court. Thomas turned 74 in June. Liberal interest groups have been clamoring for Breyer's retirement, concerned about confirmation troubles if Republicans retake the Senate. Justice Breyer's retirement is coming not a moment too soon, but now we must make sure our party remains united in support of confirming his successor, Demand Justice Executive Director Brian Fallon said. Among the names being circulated as potential nominees are California Supreme Court Justice Leandra Kruger, U.S. Circuit Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, prominent civil rights lawyer Sherrilyn Ifill, and U.S. District Judge Michelle Childs, whom Biden has nominated to be an appeals court judge. Childs is a favorite of Representative James Clyburn, Democrat of South Carolina, who made a crucial endorsement of Biden just before South Carolina's presidential primary in 2020. Democratic Representative Joyce Beatty of Ohio, chairwoman of the Congressional Black Caucus, said, "We know that when America's boardrooms, legislatures, and even the Supreme Court start to resemble America, we all benefit. Change comes slowly to the Supreme Court. Of the 115 justices in U.S. history, there have been just five women, beginning with Sandra Day O'Connor in 1981. One of the five, Justice Sonia Sotomayor, is a Latina. Thomas and the late Thurgood Marshall are the only two black men who have served on the court." The president wouldn't address reports of Breyer's retirement Wednesday. "Every justice should have an opportunity to decide what he or she is going to do and announce it on their own, Biden said. Often overshadowed by his fellow liberal Ginsburg, Breyer authored two major opinions in support of abortion rights on a court closely divided over the issue, and he laid out his growing discomfort with the death penalty in a series of dissenting opinions in recent years. Breyer's views on displaying the Ten Commandments on government property illustrate his search for a middle ground. He was the only member of the court in the majority in both cases in 2005 that barred displays in two Kentucky courthouses, but allowed one to remain on the grounds of the Capitol in Austin, Texas. In more than 27 years on the court, Breyer has been an active and cheerful questioner during arguments, a frequent public speaker, and quick with a joke, often at his own expense. He made a good-natured appearance on a humorous national public radio program in 2007, failing to answer obscure questions about pop stars. He is known for his elaborate, at times far-fetched, hypothetical questions to lawyers during arguments, and he sometimes has had the air of an absent-minded professor. He taught antitrust law at Harvard earlier in his professional career. He also spent time working for the late Senator Edward Kennedy when the Massachusetts Democrat was chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. That experience, Breyer said, made him a firm believer in compromise. Still, he could write fierce dissents, as he did in the Bush versus Gore case that effectively decided the 2000 election in favor of Republican George W. Bush. Breyer unsuccessfully urged his colleagues to return the case to the Florida courts so they could create a constitutionally proper contest to decide the winner. His time in the Senate led to his appointment by President Jimmy Carter as a federal appeals court judge in Boston, and he served there for 14 years. His 87-9 high court confirmation was the last with fewer than 10 dissenting Senate votes. Breyer's opinions were notable because they never contained footnotes. He was warned off such a writing device by Arthur Goldberg, a justice for whom Breyer clerked. It is an important point to make, if you believe as I do, that the major function of an opinion is to explain to the audience of readers why it is that the court has reached that decision, Breyer once said. It's not to prove that you're right. Dems seek swift confirmation to fill Supreme Court opening by Mary Claire Jelinek and Lisa Mascaro, the Associated Press, Byline, Washington. Senate Democrats who have played defense for the past three Supreme Court vacancies plan to move swiftly to replace retiring Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, using the rapid 2020 confirmation of Justice Amy Coney Barrett as a new standard. Barrett was confirmed exactly a month after then-President Donald Trump nominated her to replace the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and just 5 weeks after Ginsburg's death in September of that year. Democrats sharply criticized that timeline then, arguing that most confirmation had taken much longer and that Republicans were trying to jam the nomination through in case Trump lost his reelection. But now that they hold the presidency and the Senate, although just barely, Democrats navigating the complicated politics of a 50-50 chamber are looking ahead to a similarly swift schedule. In statements, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, and Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois, made clear that they would move quickly once President Joe Biden makes his pick. Schumer said the nominee will be considered and confirmed by the full United States Senate with all deliberate speed. Democrats hope to replace the 83-year-old liberal justice without complication, and some Republicans may be willing to support a Biden nominee. But Democratic leaders are keenly aware that the death or illness of just one of their ranks could flip control of the Senate and upend their plans. The Senate plans to launch the confirmation process as soon as Biden makes the nomination, regardless of when Breyer officially steps away. According to a Senate aide who is not authorized to publicly discuss the planning and spoke on condition of anonymity, Democrats could hold committee hearings quickly and even a full vote in the Senate before Breyer steps down, the aide said. The Senate would just refrain from sending the president the paperwork on the final confirmation vote until Breyer has retired. With such a narrow majority, Schumer will face heavy pressure to keep his caucus united. Two Democratic moderates, Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, have bucked their party on policy goals and could oppose a Supreme Court nominee if they considered that person too liberal. In a statement, Manchin said he takes the Senate's role to advise and consent on Supreme Court nominations very seriously and looks forward to meeting and evaluating the eventual nominee. At the same time, Democrats will be hopeful for a handful of Republican votes. Senators Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, and Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, for example, all voted last year to confirm U.S. Circuit Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, one of Biden's possible nominees. Graham indicated in a statement Wednesday that he's unlikely to support Biden's pick, whoever it may be. If all Democrats hang together, which I expect they will, they have the power to replace Justice Breyer in 2022 without one Republican vote in support, Graham said. Elections have consequences, and that is most evident when it comes to fulfilling vacancies on the Supreme Court. It will be the first time Democrats have had a Senate majority and the opportunity to fill a Supreme Court vacancy in more than 11 years. Since Justice Elena Kagan was confirmed in 2010, the GOP-led Senate has confirmed three justices nominated by Trump: Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Coney Barrett. All three of those confirmation battles were bitter for Democrats. Gorsuch, a Denver native, was confirmed a year after Republicans blocked President Barack Obama's choice to serve on the court, now Attorney General Merrick Garland. Kavanaugh was confirmed after a wrenching hearing in which a high school acquaintance, Christine Blasey Ford, charged that he had sexually assaulted her. Kavanaugh angrily denied it. Barrett was confirmed in 2020 and shifted the balance of the court. With the roles switched, frustrations have lingered on both sides about the increasingly partisan confirmation battles. Whoever the president nominates will be treated fairly and with the dignity and respect someone of his or her caliber deserves, something not afforded to Justice Kavanaugh and other Republican nominees in the past, said Republican Senator John Cornyn of Texas, who is on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Supreme Court. Three considered frontrunners as Biden Mull's pick by Colleen Long, Zeke Miller, Michael Balsamo, and Jessica Gresko. The Associated Press, Byline, Washington. President Joe Biden is considering at least three judges for an expected vacancy on the Supreme Court as he prepares to deliver quickly on his campaign pledge to nominate the first Black woman to the nation's highest court, according to aides and allies. With Justice Stephen Breyer planning to retire, early discussions about a successor are focusing on U.S. Circuit Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, U.S. District Judge J. Michelle Childs, and California Supreme Court Justice Leandra Kruger, according to four people familiar with the matter who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss White House deliberations. Jackson and Kruger have long been seen as possible nominees. Since Biden took office in January 2021, he has focused on nominating a diverse group of judges to the federal bench, installing five Black women on federal appeals courts, with three more nominations pending before the Senate. Other possible candidates for the high court could come from among that group, Biden aides and allies said, especially because almost all of the recent Supreme Court nominees have been federal appeals judges. He has a strong pool to select a candidate from, in addition to other sources. This is an historic opportunity to appoint someone with a strong record on civil and human rights, said Derek Johnson, the NAACP's president. By the end of his first year, Biden had won confirmation of 40 judges, the most since President Ronald Reagan. Of those, 80% are women and 53% are people of color, according to the White House. Jackson, 51, was nominated by President Barack Obama to be a district judge. Biden elevated her to the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. Early in her career, she was also a law clerk for Breyer. Childs, a federal judge in South Carolina, has been nominated but not confirmed yet to serve on the same circuit court. Her name has surfaced partly because she is a favorite among some high-profile lawmakers, including Representative James Clyburn, Democrat of South Carolina. Krueger, a graduate of Harvard and Yale's law school, was previously a Supreme Court clerk and has argued a dozen cases before the justices as a lawyer for the federal government. Breyer, 83, will retire at the end of the summer, according to sources. But the Senate can confirm a successor before there is a formal vacancy, so the White House was getting to work. It is expected to take at least a few weeks before a nomination is formalized. When Biden was running for the White House, he said that if he had the chance to nominate someone to the court, he would make history by choosing a black woman. And he's reiterated that pledge since. As president, I'd be honored to appoint the first African-American woman, because it should look like the country. It's long past time, Biden said in February 2020, shortly before South Carolina's presidential primary. Adding a black woman to the court would mean a series of firsts, four female justices and two black justices serving at the same time on the nine-member court. Justice Clarence Thomas is the court's only black justice, and just the second ever, after Thurgood Marshall. And Biden would have the chance to show black voters increasingly frustrated with the president they helped to elect that he is serious about their concerns, particularly after he has been unable to push through voting rights legislation. But Republicans in particular remain upset about Justice Brett Kavanaugh's contentious 2018 hearing. Still, Democrats have the 50 votes plus a tiebreaker in Vice President Kamala Harris that they need to confirm a nominee. Nonetheless, Democrats also have been unable to get all their members on board for Biden's social and environmental spending agenda or to move forward with a voting rights bill. As a senator, Biden served as chairman of the Judiciary Committee, overseeing six Supreme Court confirmation hearings from 1987 to 1995, including Breyer's. And one person who will be central to Biden's process is Chief of Staff Ron Klain, a former Supreme Court law clerk and chief counsel to that committee. Two other black women whom Biden appointed to federal appeals courts also are seen as contenders. Holly Thomas, a longtime civil rights lawyer he named to the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, and Candace Jackson Ekawumi, a former public defender he named for the Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. Biden also could choose someone from outside the judiciary, although that seems less likely. One contender would be the head of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, Sherilyn Ifill, 59. She's headed the fund since 2013 and has announced she is stepping down in the spring. The Supreme Court has had three women on it for more than a decade, since 2010, when Obama named Justice Elena Kagan to the court to replace the retiring John Paul Stevens. Kagan joined Obama's other nominee, Justice Sonia Sotomayor, the court's first Latina justice, and Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. When Ginsburg died in September 2020, Trump announced his choice of Amy Coney Barrett 8 days later. Arson killed five. Judge, two teens to be tried as adults, by Elise Schmelzer, The Denver Post. Two of the three teenagers charged with murder for allegedly setting a Denver home on fire and killing a family of five inside will be tried as adults, a judge ruled this week. Noting the trauma inflicted on the community by the 2020 fire defies comprehension. The cases against Kevin Buey and Gavin Seymour, both 17, will continue in adult court despite efforts by their attorneys to argue the cases should instead be tried in juvenile court. The case against the third suspect, who was 15 at the time of the crime and has not been publicly identified, remains in juvenile court. Denver District Judge Martin Engelhoff ruled Tuesday that Buey's and Seymour's actions were so egregious they should be tried in adult court and face more severe punishment, despite the teens' ages, lack of prior criminal record, and good behavior in juvenile detention since their arrest. In a case such as this, where the result of the defendant's conduct is the loss of not one, but five human lives, the total destruction of the home of two families, and the devastation of multiple families and communities, both locally and abroad, the community has a legitimate and significant interest in the most severe and consequential punishment commensurate with the immeasurable harm occasioned by the defendant's conduct, Engelhoff wrote. Indeed, in nearly 23 years as a judicial officer, this court has not witnessed a case of such gravity, consequence, and loss as that presented herein. The three teens set the Green Valley Ranch home on fire August 5th, 2020, because Buey erroneously thought a person who stole his phone lived there, and he wanted revenge, law enforcement officers said during a November court hearing. The teens bought masks to wear to hide their faces and splashed gasoline inside of the home before lighting it on fire, law enforcement officials testified. Five family members died in the fire. 29-year-old Jibril Dial, 23-year-old Aja Dial, their 2-year-old daughter Khadija, 25-year-old Hassan Dial, and her 6-month-old daughter Hawa Baye. All five, immigrants from West Africa who were establishing happy and productive lives in the Denver community, tragically perished, Engelhoff wrote in his order. One of them was a 2-year-old child who died in her mother's arm. Three others escaped by jumping out of the second story of the home. Police arrested the teens January 27, 2021, after a months-long investigation, and prosecutors filed 60 charges, including first-degree murder, against Buey and Seymour in Denver's adult courts. Colorado law allows prosecutors to charge teens as adults if the teen was at least 16 years old at the time of the alleged crime and if they are facing the most serious felonies. However, as in Buey's and Seymour's cases, defendants can ask the judge to send the case to juvenile court instead. Charges against the third teen were filed in juvenile court because he was 15 at the time of the fire, although prosecutors could seek to move that case to adult court. Buey was raised in a large and supportive family, Engelhoff wrote, and excelled in his school's gifted and talented academic programs. There is no evidence Buey had a mental health diagnosis prior to the alleged crime, the judge wrote. Engelhoff, in his order, did not discuss evidence in a federal gun and drug case against Buey's sister that showed the teen helped his sister sell drugs. Seymour was raised by a supportive mother and diagnosed with developmental delays at an early age, Engelhoff wrote. There's no evidence that Seymour was diagnosed with any significant mental health needs prior to the alleged arson, the judge wrote. Both have behaved well while incarcerated pending trial and have accessed programs available to them, Engelhoff wrote. Despite the fact that Engelhoff wrote both teens could be best rehabilitated in juvenile detention, the judge decided that the teens' actions deserved a harsher punishment than those available in juvenile court. Beyond the loss of five lives and the trauma inflicted upon the immediate survivors, the teens' alleged actions terrified an entire community. Juveniles convicted of first-degree murder in adult court receive a mandatory sentence of life with the possibility of parole and can be sentenced to the maximum allowed for all other counts. In juvenile court, however, the sentences for other charges are much shorter. The trauma of those five people as they tried to escape and the fear and likely pain of their subsequent deaths is beyond measure, Engelhoff wrote. The fear and trauma of those trying to effect their rescue and the devastation and loss wreaked upon the close-knit community of immigrants in the wake of the catastrophe defies comprehension. Partisan divide. Poll. Americans trust in science now deeply polarized, by Seth Borenstein and Hannah Fingerhut, The Associated Press, Byline, Washington. Republicans' faith in science is falling as Democrats rely on it even more, with the trust gap in science and medicine widening substantially during the pandemic, new survey data shows. It's the largest gap in nearly 5 decades of polling by the General Social Survey, a widely respected trend survey conducted by NORC at the University of Chicago that has been measuring confidence in institutions since 1972. That is unsurprising to more than a dozen scientists reached for comment by the Associated Press, but it concerns many of them. We are living at a time when people would rather put urine or cleaning chemicals in their body than scientifically vetted vaccines, University of Georgia meteorology professor Marshall Shepard told the Associated Press in an email. That is a clear convergence of fear, lack of critical thinking, confirmation bias, and political tribalism. Science used to be something all Americans would get behind, Rice University historian Douglas Brinkley said. But we now see it falling prey to the great partisan divide, he said. The world of science should be a meeting house where right and left can agree on data. Instead, it's becoming a sharp razor's edge of conflict. Overall, 48% of Americans say they have a great deal of confidence in the scientific community, the 2021 General Social Survey data shows. 64% of Democrats say that, compared with about half as many Republicans, 34%. The gap was much smaller in 2020, when 51% of Democrats and 42% of Republicans had high confidence. The poll also found a gap emerges on confidence in medicine, driven primarily by increasing confidence among Democrats. 45% of Democrats said they had a great deal of confidence in medicine, compared with 34% of Republicans. The deepening polarization was not evident for other institutions asked about on the poll, according to Jennifer Benz, deputy director of the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research. It's certainly plausible that this is a result of how politicized the pandemic became in the months between when it emerged and when the survey ran, Ben said. It is definitely a stark change for these particular trends in confidence in scientific leaders and leaders in medicine to see this degree of polarization. The data suggests Republicans and Democrats are following the cues of their leaders, said Anthony Lazarowitz, director of the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication. We've seen so much criticism, and worse, leveled at medical experts since the beginning of the pandemic from the former president, other Republican leaders, and the conservative media, and just the opposite from the current president, Democratic leaders, and the mainstream and liberal media, Lazarowitz told the AP in an email. Kelvin Drogemeier, former science advisor to former President Donald Trump, said he believes the pandemic increased the general public's insight into how scientific research works. But the evolving science probably seemed chaotic at times, and the urgency of the pandemic complicated policymaking. We hear, follow the science, but which results? The challenge lies in how to best use the scientific results, recognizing that what appears to be an answer one day may be overturned wholly or partly another day, Drogemeier told the AP in an email. That messiness, sometimes weak communication, and political philosophies play into the trust gap, said Marcia McNutt, president of the National Academy of Sciences, which was set up by President Abraham Lincoln to offer the federal government expert advice. Scientists and policymakers tend to be conservative, not politically, but in terms of being cautious and wary of risk, pushing safety, masks, and vaccines, while Republicans as a group value individual liberty, McNutt said. So no wonder that Republicans are less supportive of the scientifically conservative decisions in the face of uncertainty, she told the AP in an email. John Holdren, who is President Barack Obama's science advisor, said he blames GOP leaders' nonstop denial and deception. The consequences of declining trust in the scientific community among Republicans is clear. AP NORC polling shows Republicans continue to be less likely than Democrats to be vaccinated. Sudha Parikh, chief executive officer of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the world's largest general science organization, said it's clear that science has become a wedge issue for many politicians. Some have tied themselves to it, he said, and others have seen value in shooting at it because it helps them politically. It's easy in the abstract to trust science, Parikh said. When there are things that come out of that data that challenge what you are hoping the policy answer would be, you get divergence from wanting to trust the science. Parikh said he found it ironic that much of the distrust in science is spread by technology, social media, smartphones, that only exist because of scientific advances. Famed astroscientist Neil deGrasse Tyson agreed. The struggle continues, trying to get the general public to embrace all of the science the way they unwittingly embrace the science in their smartphones. Board to change equity policy. District resolution follows questions by Douglas County parents and workers by Jessica Seaman, The Denver Post. The Douglas County School Board voted Tuesday to change the district's equity policy, citing legitimate questions raised by school employees and parents regarding its assumptions and implementation. The move to change the policy, which was passed 4-3, despite objections from students who advocated for keeping it in its current state, directs the superintendent to recommend possible changes to the policy by September 1st. I and others in our community were concerned with connotations around the word equity and some concerning instances that have occurred in our school district, said board member Kaylee Winiger during the meeting about why she drafted the resolution. She cited several examples, including what she described as middle school privilege walks, which create feelings of shame and guilt. The equity policy was first passed in March 2021, almost a year into the nation's racial reckoning spurred by the police killing of George Floyd and others, and drew concerns from people worried the policy would lead Douglas County schools to teach critical race theory, according to the district's website. Critical race theory, which examines how racism has influenced public policy and institutions, such as the criminal justice system or healthcare, has become a focus for conservatives during the pandemic as Republicans across the U.S. have introduced legislation limiting how schools can teach about racism. Under the current policy, which encompasses 3 pages, the district is tasked with fixing inequitable practices and creating an equity advisory committee. The committee is to assist schools in hiring a more diverse workforce and evaluating student resources, such as curriculum, to make sure they are more representative of different groups of people. The Douglas County School District is not changing its curriculum, according to its website. The passage of the resolution comes 2 months after 4 conservative candidates won the majority on the 7-member board. There's something that's still not right in implementation of the policy, said Mike Peterson, president of the board and one of the new members. That's views of the people on the left, views of the people on the right. Susan Meek, another board member, said the resolution was the wrong way to address the issues raised, saying that she did not believe the equity policy needed to be changed without knowing exactly what language would be altered and without input from the community. I don't believe any student should feel bullied or shamed or blamed, she said. That's a violation of the equity policy. Changing the language in the equity policy, it's not that it needs to be changed. It's perhaps the implementation piece if there are issues. Meek suggested having the superintendent do a monitoring report on how the policy is implemented. Board member Elizabeth Hansen also recommended tabling the resolution in favor of such a report, but the motion failed in a 4-3 vote. The meeting's public comment section continued for about 2 hours. Most students spoke in favor of the district's equity policy, with some describing instances of racism and sexism that have occurred at school. Parents and other community members who spoke mostly supported the policy. However, some advocated for changing it. The Denver Post was unable to get speaker names. Kids are eating lunch in the bathroom because they don't want to be tormented about their race, who they are, or what they believe in, said one sophomore. Hancock picks Brendan Hanlon as deputy mayor. Denver's chief financial officer, Brendan Hanlon, is now also the city's deputy mayor for the second time during his tenure in Michael Hancock's administration. The mayor's office sent out a news release Wednesday announcing Hanlon's designation. It began January 1st and will run through the end of the year. As outlined in the city charter, The mayor must name a member of his or her cabinet to be deputy mayor. The person in that position is tasked with carrying out the duties and responsibilities of the mayor if, for any reason, the elected mayor cannot do so. Hanlon was named the city's CFO in 2016 after previously working as its budget director. He also was Hancock's designated deputy mayor in 2018. Wednesday's release lauded him for his work addressing the financial impacts of the pandemic. Previous deputy mayors under Hancock include Happy Haynes, executive director of Denver Parks and Recreation, and Murphy Robinson, the city's director of public safety, who was slated to leave the administration this month. This was by Joe Rubino, the Denver Post. Larimer County to reevaluate mask mandate. At a community conversation Tuesday afternoon about COVID-19 and the county's response to it, Larimer County Director of Public Health Tom Gonzalez said that differences between the Omicron and Delta variants would prompt officials to reevaluate the countywide mask mandate in the coming weeks. He did not offer additional details. A survey found that the 250 participants on the virtual meeting prioritized individual responsibility first, followed by public health, mental health, family, empathy and concern for the most vulnerable, freedom or liberty, economic vitality, supporting small business, employee safety, and need for connection, in that order. This is from the Reporter Herald. Legislature. Union bill faces many hurdles, including POLIS, by Alex Burness, the Denver Post. Democrats seeking this year to install sweeping new union rights for hundreds of thousands of Colorado public employees are up against a familiar obstacle in Governor Jared POLIS, and they're in talks about scaling back their bill to get it passed and signed into law. What they want to do is confer the right to unionize and bargain collectively upon firefighters, teachers, snowplow drivers, and other workers across the public sector, where labor rights are fewer than in the private sector. Some of these workers already belong to unions, and a smaller subset engages in collective bargaining over pay, benefits, and working conditions. The proposal in question would force public sector employers to recognize unions when workers form them and to negotiate contracts with those unions. What lawmakers will end up pursuing is almost certainly less ambitious than that. We need to figure out what is the right structure for how folks would create a union, collectively bargain, and who is included in that and who might not be included, said Senate Majority Leader Steve Fenberg, a Boulder Democrat and a lead sponsor of the bill, which has yet to be introduced. Fenberg and his co-lead, House Majority Leader and Pueblo Democrat Danaya Escar, are facing plenty of opposition and are likely to face even more as their effort advances. Bills don't become laws without the governor's signature, and he has taken the rare, for him anyway, step of going public with concerns about Democratic legislation. POLIS, also a Democrat, said this month that he would not support the proposal in its current form. It's not clear what that form is. The bill's sponsors have not released drafts, but it's clear that the proponent's goal creates bigger changes than POLIS wants right now. He could support much narrower legislation, his office said. POLIS has, on multiple recent occasions, declined to say much more on the topic. He told the Denver Post last week he wouldn't negotiate in the press and reiterated that at a news conference Tuesday. We are in talks trying to bring together local government and workers' representatives around a solution that will work for Colorado, he said. POLIS ran for governor as a friend to labor, but his record in office isn't so clear. He opposed a 2019 bill to let state employees bargain collectively, but backed it in 2020. When the Denver Post asked POLIS on January 13th to comment on the since-resolved King Soopers worker strike, he declined to take a side in the labor dispute and sidestepped a question about whether he would cross the picket line. On January 18th, he told Colorado Public Radio he wouldn't cross the picket line. Lobbyists and lawmakers say they are trying to discern what exactly POLIS wants. Polis has frustrated Colorado Democrats on other issues during his first term. His positions at many points haven't lined up neatly or even roughly with those of most Democrats in the state, House, and Senate, which has made for more intra-party policy fights than lawmakers planned for when he ran on a largely progressive platform. With the 2022 legislative session barely 2 weeks old, Fenberg seems to have accepted that whatever gets introduced will not be entirely true to his stated guiding principle. No matter who you work for, you should have some basic rights and be able to collectively bargain with your coworkers. Does that mean I'll only accept a perfect bill? No, of course not. That's not the world we live in, he said. I never expected this bill or any other bill to be perfect. Neither Fenberg nor Eskar offered specifics as to which kinds of workers or workplaces might be left out of the bill. We're still in the process of going through the bill step by step with Polis and his office to really see what it is that he can go with and what he'll draw a line in the sand with, said Eskar, a sponsor of the 2019 and 2020 state employee bills, and thus a veteran of the negotiating with Jared Polis on labor experience. We've had multiple meetings, and we have multiple meetings to go, she said. Just last week, she predicted the bill could debut this month. Now she's hesitant to put a date on it. These lawmakers may well have to work on some of their own colleagues, too, in addition to their talks with Polis. The bill will start in the House, where Democrats have a 41-24 edge over Republicans and can go fairly progressive without risking policy defeats. But the margin is narrower in the Senate, 20-15, and so just 3 Democratic no votes can kill a policy. Moderates, such as Arvada Democratic State Senator Rachel Zinziger, can yield considerable power in Senate negotiations, as they did on the so-called public option health insurance bill from last year, or the bill to create broad new paid family and medical leave benefits for workers. I'm going to be cautious, and I'm not just going to hop on board quite yet until I know the details, Zinziger said of the public sector union bill. Every bill has to operate in the context of the moment you're trying to pass it. Right now, we have to think about the economy, labor shortages, all sorts of things that impact the reality of how this bill is situated. Opposition from lawmakers on the left is possible, but it's guaranteed from those on the right, said State Senator Larry Liston, a Colorado Springs Republican who serves on the Senate's Business, Labor, and Technology Committee. The public sector proposal would have a gargantuan fiscal impact on these cities, on other public sector employees. The people are not asking for this. I don't hear it at all from my constituents. He said workers he's talked to don't want it either. The fire department in his own city has tried and failed multiple times to get voters to let them bargain collectively, permission they wouldn't need under the Democrats' proposal. Asked whether those ballot efforts disprove his assessment that workers don't want greater union rights, Liston said, "Everybody wants to grease their skids, but the majority, the basic rank and file, they go, you know, I really don't need this." He predicted 0 Republicans would vote for the concept. Well, maybe 1, Liston added, gesturing toward the desk of moderate state senator Kevin Priola, a Henderson Republican who often sides with Democrats. No, Priola told the Post, I'm not a fan of that policy. Neither are some potent lobbying groups, including those representing local governments. The Colorado Municipal League, which lobbies for towns and cities across the state, has argued that the proposal violates local control laws. It will have plenty of allies making that case, if and when there's a bill to speak of. Given its connection to hundreds of different governments and employers, the bill is likely to be among the most heavily lobbied of the 2022 session. Labor leaders and their legislative supporters say the bill is not existentially threatened, that it is indeed coming. Eskar and Fenberg went as far as to say they are confident their bill will become law, even if they don't know exactly what it will say. I think there's a lot of room to land somewhere where everyone can agree, Fenberg said, genuinely. now limited to public health emergency, Dems want to extend whistleblower protections, by Saja Hindi, the Denver Post. A law passed in 2020 to protect employees who raise concerns about workplace violations of health and safety during a declared public health emergency has resulted in 126 complaints alleging retaliation since it was signed into law. Colorado House Representative Leslie Herod, a Denver Democrat, says this is evidence that HB 20-1415, passed mostly along party lines, is working. Herod, Senator Robert Rodriguez, Senator Brittany Pedersen, and Representative Tom Sullivan plan to introduce another whistleblower bill this week that would expand these protections for private and public sector workers even beyond a declared public health emergency. The bill aims to prevent employers from discriminating or retaliating against their workers for bringing up safety concerns and would allow employees to file related complaints to the Colorado Department of Labor and Employment for review before taking issues to court. Herod provided data from the Colorado Department of Labor and Employment during a news conference Wednesday and said the state agency is actively investigating 8 complaints under the 2020 law, with 30 in review pending a notice of right to sue. Of 96 claims reviewed and full investigations of 11, 7 resulted in settlements, 4 in a final determination, 33 issued a notice of right to sue, 4 withdrew their complaints, and the remainder were dismissed. I know, and I think we can all agree, that no one in our state should fear losing their job or being retaliated against, losing wages, just for standing up for their own rights, she said. The pandemic exposed many health and safety concerns in the workplace, but those concerns existed long before COVID and will continue to exist after the emergency declaration and we are through this pandemic. Samantha Scarborough, an ICU nurse and union member of CWA 7799, shared her own experiences working in a busy hospital during the pandemic, where employees were using masks beyond their recommended use, sharing respirators, and working with what she called unsafe staffing levels. Without whistleblower protection, things like this go unchecked, Scarborough said at the event Wednesday. The protection empowers workers to speak up. It empowers them to make a change in a positive way instead of being afraid or just quitting. If we have any hope of keeping this crumbling healthcare system standing and improving, people on the front line need protection to help make that change. Educators have also been dealing with these types of issues, according to Robin Handy from the Douglas County Federation, which represents teachers and staff members. Handy said the group had to get involved in a case with one educator who had reported safety measures not being followed in a school, first to the principal and then to the director of schools when nothing changed. The teacher ultimately received a disciplinary letter for unprofessional conduct and negative marks on an evaluation, Handy said, before the group intervened. All employees, including teachers and staff, deserve to work in an environment free from retaliation when reporting unsafe and inappropriate practices, Handy said. COVID-19 vaccines, mandate to begin for first wave of health workers, by David A. Lieb and Heather Hollingsworth, The Associated Press. Healthcare workers in about half the states face a Thursday deadline to get their first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine under a Biden administration mandate that will be rolled out across the rest of the country in the coming weeks. Although the requirement is welcomed by some, others fear it will worsen serious staff shortages if employees quit rather than comply. And in some Republican-led states that have taken a stand against vaccine mandates, hospitals and nursing homes could find themselves caught between conflicting state and federal demands. We would like to see staff vaccinated. We think that it's the safest option for residents, which is our biggest concern, said Marjorie Moore, executive director of VOICE, a St. Louis County, Missouri nonprofit that works on behalf of nursing home residents. But not having staff is also a really big concern, because the neglect that happens as a result of that is severe and very scary. The mandate affects a wide swath of the healthcare industry, covering doctors, nurses, technicians, aides, and even volunteers at hospitals, nursing homes, home health agencies, and other providers that participate in the federal Medicare or Medicaid programs. It comes as many places are stretched thin by the Omicron surge, which is putting record numbers of people in the hospital with COVID-19, while sickening many health workers. Nationwide, about 81% of nursing home staff members were fully vaccinated as of this month, ranging from a high of 98% in Rhode Island to a low of 67% in Missouri, according to the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. The data is unclear about the vaccination levels in hospitals and other healthcare sites. The mandate ultimately will cover 10.4 million healthcare workers at 76,000 facilities. It is taking effect first in jurisdictions that didn't challenge the requirement in court. Those include some of the biggest states, with some of the largest populations of senior citizens, among them California, Florida, New York, and Pennsylvania. There absolutely have been employee resignations because of vaccination requirements, said Catherine Babiri, a Philadelphia attorney at Fox Rothschild, who represents healthcare providers. But I think it's relatively small. At Wilson Medical Center in rural Neodesha, Kansas, three of the approximately 180 employees are quitting, and several others have sought exemptions from the vaccine mandate, said hospital spokeswoman Janice Reese. We are very fortunate that that is all we are losing, she said, noting that the hospital was not in favor of the mandate. We didn't feel like it was our place to actually try to tell a person what they had to do. Reese said the vaccine requirement could make it more difficult for the hospital to fill vacancies. The states affected on Thursday are California, Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Florida, Hawaii, Illinois, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, Nevada, New Jersey, New Mexico, New York, North Carolina, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Tennessee, Vermont, Virginia, Washington, and Wisconsin, along with the District of Columbia and U.S. territories. In news briefs, U.S. offers no concessions to Russia on Ukraine. Byline, Washington. The Biden administration and NATO told Russia on Wednesday there will be no U.S. or NATO concessions on Moscow's main demands to resolve the crisis over Ukraine. In separate written responses delivered to the Russians, the U.S. and NATO held firm to the alliance's open-door policy for membership, rejected a demand to ban Ukraine permanently from joining, and said allied deployments of troops and military equipment in Eastern Europe are non-negotiable. There is no change. There will be no change, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said. Also not up for negotiation will be the U.S. and European response to any Russian invasion of Ukraine, he said, repeating the mantra that any such incursion would be met with massive consequences and severe economic costs. Feds accused Texas man of selling gun used to take hostages, byline Dallas. A Texas man has been charged with a federal gun crime after authorities say he sold a gun to a man who held four hostages inside a Texas synagogue this month before being fatally shot by the FBI, the Justice Department said Wednesday. Henry Michael Williams, 32, was charged with being a felon in possession of a firearm after authorities say he sold the weapon that Malik Fasil Akram used when he entered Congregation Beth Israel in Colleyville, Texas on January 15th and held the synagogue's rabbi and three others hostage for hours. Akram, a 44-year-old British citizen, held hostages in the Dallas area suburb while demanding the release of a federal prisoner. The standoff ended after more than 10 hours when the temple's rabbi threw a chair at Akram and fled with the other two remaining hostages just as a technical team from the FBI was moving in. None of the hostages was hurt. Prosecutors say Williams sold Akram a semi-automatic pistol January 13th, 2 days before the hostage taking. The pistol was recovered from the scene. Also Wednesday, police in Manchester, England, arrested two more men Wednesday in connection to the hostage situation. The men arrested Wednesday were not identified, but police said they remained in custody for questioning. Firefighter says she urged officers to let her help Floyd. Byline, St. Paul, Minnesota. A Minneapolis firefighter who witnessed police officers holding George Floyd face down on a city street testified Wednesday that the three officers on federal trial for allegedly violating Floyd's civil rights ignored her pleas to help administer medical aid to the unresponsive black man. Genevieve Hansen was off duty on May 25, 2020, but said she identified herself as a Minneapolis firefighter when she saw Floyd on the ground. She testified at the trial of former officers J. Alexander Kyung, Thomas Lane, and To Thao that she could see Floyd's head being pressed onto the street under the knee of former officer Derek Chauvin, while other officers helped hold him down. It was just alarming, the amount of people that were on top of one person, not moving and handcuffed, said Hansen, who said she's a trained emergency medical technician and acknowledged that she got louder and began swearing because Floyd needed help and he wasn't getting it. Kyung, Lane, and Thao are charged broadly with depriving Floyd of his civil rights while acting under government authority. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.